So what I am planning to do today is quickly complete the discussion on Bayesian learning for Bayes networks, which I started talking about towards the end of last class, and this idea of taking priors over hypotheses, etc. And then I'll change gears a little bit and discuss undirected graphical models, probabilistic graphical models, because they came up in discussion many times and I didn't do it in 471, and so I thought of owe it to you to actually do some amount of how to do inference and how to do learning in Markov networks. So for example, remember I kept saying things like when Bayes networks were being discussed, that for the complete data, for learning, parameter learning for Bayes networks, decouples. That means each parameter would be its own equation. You know, the gradient would be such that each partial derivative would only include one parameter. And I said, in the case of Markov nets, these mythical beasts, these undirected models, things will get entangled even for the complete data case. Okay. And essentially, I want to actually, you know, give you a background on Markov networks and how you define Markov networks, how you do inference on Markov networks, and how to do learning on Markov networks. This will be faster, hopefully, because we already know how to do all this stuff for Bayes networks. Okay. And my actual hope is that if I do this fast enough, then I would also like to end the semester with an overview of an idea called Markov logic networks, which is one specific form of lifted probabilistic reasoning. That means relational probabilistic reasoning. Okay. It's not that there aren't any relational models for Bayesian the probabilistic Bayes networks. It is that Markov logic networks are actually sort of, they're more advanced right now in terms of the amount of work that's been done. So it might be worth talking about that. So that's the direction that we're going to take, and we'll see how far we'll go with that. Okay. So problems, and as this stuff I already mentioned last time, I'm going to quickly go through this, that, you know, maximum likelihood based estimation will ultimately give you the trouble because you don't quite know how to differentiate between one head in three trials versus 1 million heads in 3 million trials. Okay, somehow you would like to believe that getting 1 million heads in 3 million trials means the probability of getting heads is really 1/3. Whereas one head in three trials, you really are not sure. Okay, how do you differentiate those two cases? And the idea, of course, is Bayesian learning can handle this, where Bayesian learning essentially starts with a prior on the hypothesis. Okay, and then as the examples come in, you are computing the posterior on the hypothesis space. And if there are enough examples, then the posterior on the hypothesis space is mostly completely determined by the data rather than the prior that you started with. Okay, and so prior essentially is, this is what we call preconceived notion. Okay, everybody tends to say preconceived notion, prejudice, they're all used in a bad way, but without prejudices, without preconceived notions, you'd be dead in this world. Okay, I mean, we normally use it in a bad way because, oh, how can you prejudge me? How can you be prejudiced? But really, if every time you go onto the road, you want to take a fresh look at how road behaves. I don't want to give any prejudices. You know, maybe these trucks will stop right in front of me. You know, you'd be dead. Okay. In fact, one of the most interesting things is that the biased reasoning is what got us to be alive. And so we do more of it. And when you do it for humans, you know, all sorts of problems occur. But preconceived notions are the prior that you have, that's the background knowledge you have. It's stupid not to have any preconceived notions, and it's also stupid to not differentiate even after a huge number of examples that your preconceived notions are wrong. So for example, I came from India, and so let's say that people are driving on the left side, people tend to walk on the left side, and so that's my preconceived notion. But after the first guy who tries to, you know, hit me because he's walking on his right side and I'm walking on my left side, I could say, oh, that's a bozo. You know, he hasn't yet figured out how to walk. Second, yes. Third, yes. You know, after 15,000, I should be able to give up on my preconceived notions and say, well, really, people seem to be walking on the wrong side here. Okay? And so the idea then is that you start with a prior and you let the data override your prior. In maximum likelihood, you don't have any prior at all, essentially. Okay? So the question, of course, the tricky question technically is how do you write the priors over the hypothesis space? Okay. Now it turns out that if you are looking at the coin toss experiment and you don't quite know how likely the coin toss, you know, coin is going to come heads or tails, and you're trying to learn it from the data, then so your hypothesis are all completely the theta values. The theta is your hypothesis. So theta equal to 0.5 is one hypothesis. 0.501 is another hypothesis. 0.5085 is another hypothesis. These are all the probabilities that the next toss will be heads. Okay. Now question, of course, is the prior over hypothesis then will be essentially a probability distribution over the theta values. Probability distribution over the theta values. Okay, so here is theta, and then basically maybe I have something like that. Okay, I have something like that. Of course, this is 0 and this is 1. You know, prior the theta is only, you know, 0 to 1. Okay, so any distribution on this theta would be a prior. That's my preconceived notion about how theta varies in the world. Okay, so for example, if I have, let's say, something like this, then what I think is theta is most likely to be here, but there is, you know, some chance that it's here and here without looking at the data. This is what I've decided. But having looked at the data, then I compute the posterior, which may change. Okay, that's the basic idea. Okay, So all you need now is H is really, really a random variable now. H is basically a hypothesis which is defined in terms of theta. So theta is a random variable. Just as the heads or tails, the coin toss itself is a random variable, the theta itself is a random variable. Okay? You're learning the theta values based on the coin toss values. Okay? Now the prior distribution, so starting from prior and theta, we can just need to compute the posterior, which is probability of HI given data is, of course, some normalization constant times probability of data given HI, which is just, this part is just your likelihood, right? And times probability of HI, which is the distribution over the hypothesis. Okay. Now, this is the part that we need to have a distribution, okay? So the challenge really is, you know, if you don't care about computational issues, then it's all done. You know, I just give a distribution, and then I can essentially integrate this distribution. I can essentially compute the posterior using the Bayes rule. Okay, and then of course, once I have the new posterior, I essentially compute both the expected. The prediction will be done using all the hypotheses, such that the more likely hypothesis give higher weight. Yes? So this is basically, this is just a normalization constant. Okay, so the idea is if you only have, we talked about this earlier, if you only have two hypotheses, H1 and H2, those are the only ones that you have. Okay, and so what you're really computing is probability of H1 given D as well as probability of H2 given D. Okay, for both of them, using Bayes rule, it will be probability of D given H1 times probability of H1 by probability of D. Okay, and then this one too is probability of D given H2 times probability of H2 by probability of D. Now it turns out that these two should add up to 1. And so I can always ignore this and say this is alpha And then basically, so I get a number, let's say here, 0.9 here, 0.7 here. Then all I know is 0.9 plus 0.7 needs to be equal to 1. So you recompute. So this is alpha times 0.9, this is alpha times 0.7. So you know what alpha should be. Okay, that's basically the usual thing you do. This is a normalization constant in, you know, when computing the distribution. Okay, so the idea, of course, is can you, when you multiply this likelihood, multiply this likelihood by the prior, then I'm getting a posterior. Really, the complete prior. So one of the games that people play in probabilistic reasoning is saying there is something called PHI, that is probability of a variable given no evidence at all. There is never, ever, ever, ever in the universe any time where there is no evidence at all. You always know something. Okay? Really, all you are saying is the prior essentially is before the problem even started, you have some background evidence. You ignore, you assume background evidence is just a background, everybody has it. Okay? So really what you're talking about is a prior is probability of H1 given the background evidence. Now, what you want to compute is probability of H1 given background evidence and the data. Little extra evidence. So really, this, so basically the prior, this posterior will now take the form of, the place of the prior in the, when the next data comes along. Okay, so what would be useful is irrespective of whatever distribution you used here, after you multiply this distribution with this likelihood, if it is again in the same parametric form, then you would be in sort of a good shape, technically speaking. Semantically, it makes no difference. Technically, if you have a distribution and multiply it by a likelihood, you get the same distribution back with slightly different parameters, then it's great. So you start with Gaussian and you get Gaussian back. Or you start with something else, Poisson, and then get Poisson back. And that's not obvious because depending on any arbitrary, if you start with any arbitrary, you know, prior, there's no real reason that it, that would have to happen. So since it helps your life technically, okay, so you are interested especially for continuous hypothesis spaces. This is a continuous hypothesis space because every theta value is a separate hypothesis. In continuous hypothesis spaces, you're looking for priors that have this symbiotic relationship with the likelihood function, such that when you multiply the likelihood by the prior, the product would again be in the same parametric form as the prior. If that is true, then that family of parametric priors are called conjugate priors to the likelihood function. Okay? Okay, now basically, for, you know, if you're doing coin toss, the likelihood is generally likelihood, right? Because if, you know, theta is the probability, if you have k heads and, you know, m tails, then theta power k and 1 minus theta power m is the likelihood. That's the Bernoulli likelihood. Okay, now what is interesting is there is a family of distributions that you basically have called beta distribution. Okay, these are again, you know, for continuous variables, you know, you remember that you always had to look for parameterized distributions. There is no other way. Okay, and so this one is called a beta distribution. A beta distribution has two hyperparameters, A and B, and it basically, beta AB, theta would be, you know, theta power A minus 1, 1 minus theta power B minus 1. That's the distribution. Okay, so theta is your random variable, and if it is following an AB beta distribution, okay, then it basically the form, closed form distribution is theta power A minus 1, 1 minus theta power B minus 1. Now, of course, this describes a function, right? Now, because this is, especially because this theta is a continuous variable, it defines a nice little function. You have to make sure that the normalization constant is such that when you integrate this function from 0 to 1, you will get 1. Otherwise, it won't be a probability distribution. Okay? What's interesting is that we will just throw, in fact, by abusing notation, I again say a different alpha. In fact, this should be called alpha dash, you know. In fact, what's interesting is in the ensuing, you know, I would use this alpha again. Okay, but right now, I need a normalization constant. I'll just call it alpha. This is different from this alpha. Okay? All this is going to do is it ensures that the integration becomes equal to 1. The integration over 0 to 1 becomes equal to 1. And that particular normalization constant essentially is called the gamma function, and it is sort of, it's not important for you, but it turns out it's a gamma function, and it has the property that gamma of x plus 1 is equal to x times gamma of x. I mean, x plus 1 is gamma of x plus, yeah, gamma of x plus 1 is equal to x plus 1 times gamma of x. Okay, which is exactly sort of like the continuous version of the factorial function.
So what if you have more than one attribute, like, you know, you're getting your attributes are multiple?
No, no, yeah, so I'm looking at, we'll get that in a place. You know, right now I'm looking for only one single parameter. In the coin toss experiment, I have just a single parameter. Okay, and that parameter varies in the Bernoulli distribution. So its likelihood would be Bernoulli likelihood. And if I start with the beta distribution as the prior on the parameter, okay, the fact that this alpha is a normalization constant, that actually you can actually compute what its value should be for each different value of A and B. That's a different issue. We are not interested in that for now. All you really care about is, suppose when you get a data and you update, okay, so you started, let's say, this is the beta distribution, this beta distribution is the prior on your theta, on your hypothesis space. Okay, now, suppose I got one data, this is again, you know, I picked a candy and it turned out to be a cherry. Okay, I want to compute what is the posterior distribution of theta given not just the background evidence, but also this extra evidence that I just found a candy which is cherry. Right? That would be written as, now I'm changing alpha, this alpha times probability that d1 equal to cherry given theta times probability of theta. Right? And this is d1 given cherry, d1 equal to cherry is, remember, if you remember the way we, cherry is the good thing, lime is the bad thing, so heads are good things, tails are bad things, so we assumed that theta is the probability of coming up with cherry. Okay, so this probability is just theta. And this other probability, p theta, okay, is the beta distribution. So that's beta AB theta, which is nothing but, if you take this alpha and this alpha, these are two different alphas, I will call their multiplication a new constant, alpha dash, okay, times theta power A minus 1, times 1 minus theta power B minus 1. What's interesting is, this theta can go inside, it just becomes theta and 1 minus theta power B. So if you look at that expression, that's another beta distribution, except with parameters A plus 1 and B, rather than parameters A and B. Do you understand what I'm saying? So, to give you a feel for how actually beta distributions look, this is how beta distributions look for different values of A and B. Okay? If it is 1 and 1, it just will be uniform distribution. Okay? A equal to 1, B equal to 1. And this is A equal to 2, B equal to 2. This is A equal to 5, B equal to 5. Okay, what's interesting is, as long as A and B values remain same, if their relative value, if their magnitudes keep increasing, then in essence, so for example, A equal to 1000, B equal to 1000 would be a very sharply peaked distribution at 0.5. Okay, and the same thing, if you have alpha A equal to 1, B equal to 3, I mean A equal to 1, B equal to 2, there will be a 1/3. So it will be a distribution that sort of, whose peak is at the 1/3 left side. and A equal to 1 million, B equal to 2 million would be having the mode at the same place, but it will be a much more, you know, sharper peak. Okay? So, essentially, upfront, if you didn't know anything, then this is basically whatever is AB, that's your distribution over the hypothesis. And when you see, for example, when you see data coming in, so for 3, 1, A equal to 3 and B equal to 1, it looks like this. A equal to 6, B equal to 2 looks like this. A equal to 30, B equal to 10 looks like this, which is what I was saying. So all of them have the same ratio, except the 30-10 one will be much more sharply peaked. Okay. Now what happens given this and this, what's happening is if I started with A equal to 1, B equal to 1, that's like, so like, let's say if I started with A equal to 1, B equal to 1, which is, you know, so going back to this previous case, if I started with a coin and I assumed with a prior distribution was A equal to 1, B equal to 1 in the beta distribution, which basically meant that I sort of assume A equal to 1, B equal to 1 would be closely uniform. Okay, A equal to 50, B equal to 50 would be sharply peaked at 0.5. Now, if I get 1 million more heads and 2 million more tails in the next 3 million data, then I would basically, this thing essentially will make it be a beta distribution with 1 million plus 50 and 2 million plus 50. And that would essentially have a very sharp peak, a very sharp peak at the one-third region. Okay, which is part of what you wanted. So this, the new beta distribution is showing you the posterior of the hypothesis given the data until now. Okay, so as I said, distributions that have this property that for a given likelihood, if you multiply the likelihood by the distribution, you will be in the same distribution family, those are called conjugate priors. Okay, and for the kinds of distributions that you are likely to see, people have figured out what the conjugate distributions are. Okay, for example, for Bernoulli distribution, beta distribution is the conjugate. And if you have a coin, if you have a die that's being passed, that's a multinomial distribution, right? It's 1, 6, 1, 6, 1, 6, or, you know, 6 probabilities, all of which add up to 1. In the case of multinomial distribution, you essentially, that's sort of a generalization of Bernoulli likelihood. It's theta 1 power k and theta 2 power j and theta 3 power L such that k plus j plus L plus whatever should be equal to 1. I mean, it should be equal to the total number of samples. Okay. And the theta should be adding up to 1. Okay. Now that's called a multinomial likelihood distribution, and you know there is a equivalent one for beta, just as beta is to Bernoulli distribution, there is something called Dirichlet distribution. And that is used to provide priors for multinomial distribution. Now, if you think about what happens in a normal Bayes network, if you provide CPDs, you have discrete variables and you are providing CPTs. Those CPTs are setting up a multinomial distribution. If you have discrete variable, it can take k different values, and your CPTs are telling you what's the probability that you'll take that value given your parents' values. Okay? So all the CPTs in a normal Bayes network, which is not using parameterized conditional probability tables, they're all multinomial distributions. So if you are setting up conjugates for Bayes networks, you just use Dirichlet prior. And Dirichlet priors look almost like this. Essentially, instead of theta power a minus 1 and 1 minus theta power b minus 1, they will have theta 1 power a minus 1, theta 2 power b minus 1, theta 3 power c minus 1, whatever. Okay? And then equivalently, there would be a separate gamma function that will be a normalization constant. Okay. Now, what's interesting is that, so in fact, if you just look in the literature, you'll every once in a while see papers saying, you know, Dirichlet distribution flyers. And that's what they're doing. They're essentially trying to do learning, Bayesian learning on Bayes networks. Okay, and if you were to provide a prior, the conjugate prior would be Dirichlet distribution. And Dirichlet is just a multinomial version of beta distribution. Okay? Okay, and then if you, God forbid, have Gaussian conditional distribution, then there is a continuous distribution for Gaussian which is conjugate with respect to Gaussian. That means if you take the Gaussian likelihood, multiply it by this distribution, you will get back this distribution format. And those are called normal Weishaupt distributions. Okay, so the reason, I mean, what I want you to understand is conjugate priors are useful for technical reasons. They're not for semantic reasons. You could very well say that, look, what I really think about the parameters of this particular, coin, my feeling is it's like this. The parameter theta is distributed like this. That's what I think. Okay? So I really believe it's multimodal. I am allowed to think so. I can come into this world and think that all yellow trucks are polite, all green trucks run over people. And you can say, why the heck are you thinking? That's just, you don't get to ask me. I get to have my prejudices. Right? So the question then is, if I have this as my prior, it would not be conjugate prior to Bernoulli likelihood. Because I start with whatever is the form of this prior, and I have to compute the posterior, which might look like that. That is not, in the case of continuous distribution, there is no easy way of writing the distribution unless you have a closed form. So you will then have to use samples to keep the distribution along. Okay? Otherwise, you would say, well, okay, this is what you think, then I want to use a beta distribution that is closest to yours. That's like that. So that's your close approximation. I'll use that beta distribution, and then I'll do the Bayesian learning. In which case, I fit a beta distribution that's closest to what you think is your prior. Okay? So semantically, nothing stops you from having a non-conjugate prior on the theta. Technically, it makes a whole lot of sense to have a conjugate prior, if possible. But sometimes it may not be possible. If you really believe that this coin is one of two different coins, right, then you really believe it has a bimodal distribution. And beta distribution is a unimodal distribution. It would never have two modes. Okay? So that's the deal with conjugate priors. And, I'll get back to this in a minute, but let me, if you are using conjugate priors with respect to a full Bayes network, okay, in the previous case, it was a single node Bayes network. Single node Bayes network. Theta just didn't depend upon anything. Okay, theta is the, there's only one variable, which is whether it's heads or tails, or whether it's cherry or lime. And then theta is affecting it. Okay, here, for example, I have more of a different, I have both flavor and wrapper. Okay, so remember we also looked at a candy example where you have both flavor and wrapper, and you even had, holes in some of the examples. Okay, so now if I have flavor and wrapper, then, so basically I assume that theta is deciding which flavor I'm getting. Okay, and then, and flavor then decides wrapper, but the wrapper is also determined by the other theta I parameter. Okay, and so now you have this very interesting Bayes network where the data attributes are nodes, and so are the parameters you're trying to learn. They're also nodes. Okay, and you use the same Bayes inference techniques on both theta, both these parameters and the data points. This is what we were saying earlier when we said in a Bayes network, if you're doing Bayesian learning, there's no difference between learning If you're doing Bayes learning, then there's no difference between learning and inference. Notice I'm not maximizing. There's no optimization going on, no derivatives, no derivatives set to zero, no ascent, no descent, nothing. I'm just computing posterior probability given the data. Okay? So the last point before we move on from this is where exactly if I have, so I have now, after this conjugate prior thing, as I see the data, I get a beta distribution which tells me the posterior on my hypothesis. Okay? Now I can always say, take the mode of this distribution and say that's the single hypothesis. But that looks like wasted effort. If you are keeping track of the entire posterior and all the hypotheses, then why just pick the most likely hypothesis at that point? Instead, what you really want to do is, given this, let's say this is my hypothesis, current posterior hypothesis, okay, then based on this value, there is a probability that the next item would be heads. Based on this value, there's a different probability. Based on this value, there's a different probability. I compute the expected value. Okay, the expected value of the next path being heads, the next candy being, next task being heads or next candy being, cherry, is what I'm going to compute. What's more interesting is, since I actually have a distribution over hypothesis, I can differentiate. Now I can not only find the expected value. So notice that. Somebody, when I tried to, if I was actually, you know, starting basically in the same world where essentially the true parameters are 1/4, I mean 3/4 is the true parameter in this case, right? 3/4 is the true parameter. After only 8 data pieces, or maybe less than 8 data pieces, I would have had this distribution. After less than 40, close to 40, I would have this distribution. In both cases, the most likely values for theta are approximately the same. But your uncertainty as to whether the winning value of theta is the best value is much higher. Normally, in learning, not only should you be predicting what the next guy is going to be, but you should be providing a confidence on that. Right? In the maximum likelihood learning, there is no easy way of providing confidence on your prediction. Because this hypothesis just stands alone. It's the most likely hypothesis. That's it. How less likely is the next most likely hypothesis is what you really want to know. You know, in particular, how peaked is the posterior distribution. But we lost the posterior distribution. So we really don't know, when I said this is the most like highest, you know, this is the most likely hypothesis, whether the next guy is also here, 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 or the next guy is here and here. In this case, much higher confidence of your prediction. In this case, your prediction is not very confident. Okay? In the ML-based learning, in statistical learning, basically people use these ideas called p-values, which from the statistics community, when they use frequentist learning, estimator-based learning, they use these ideas called p-values, which provide the confidence. But p-values have no direct statistical semantics. If I'm doing Bayesian learning, on the other hand, since I have the posterior, I can not only compute the expected value of the next data point, but I can also compute the variance on the prediction. Do you see what I'm saying? So I can say the next is going to be 7 plus or minus 5. Okay? And so in fact, I can provide both the variance and the expected value. So this actually is a much better sort of learning in a way. Okay? Okay, so in terms of expected value itself, for our case, what you really need to do, to, you know, if, since you have a, you have to basically, since you have posterior, which is telling me, so basically I'm trying to compute what is the probability that the next guy is going to be heads. okay? And to compute that, I essentially take this expression, probability that the next guy would be heads, given that theta is the value of the parameter, times the probability that theta will actually be the value of the parameter. This p theta is the posterior, current posterior distribution over d theta. Okay? And you integrate that. That will give you the expected value. It's a painful integration in this particular, even for this simple case, but if after seeing dh heads and dt tails, your beta, if you started with a beta with parameters a and b, after seeing dh heads and dt tails, you would be in a beta distribution which is a plus dh and b plus dt, right? H being tails and, I mean, heads and t being tails, right? That would be your beta distribution. So what you're doing is you are throwing this as p theta, and then heads given theta is just theta itself. So I'm integrating theta times this d theta. Okay, that integral will have this value. If you remember your integration, then if you complete that integration, then that will give you the following value. It's a plus dh by a plus dh plus b plus dt. Okay, now if dh and dt are much bigger than a and b, then it is nothing but dh by dh plus dt, which is what ML was telling you. If dh and dt are about the same value as a and b, then a and b kind of moderate the change. So just because a coin came one heads and two tails, you don't right away say, oh, the next toss will be coming with half probability, I mean one third probability heads. You would still say next coin will be coming heads with half probability. But if this thing continues for the next 3 million trials, then you say, yes, the next coin is going to come up with one-third probability heads. So this is basically what the Bayesian prediction would be, Bayesian learning prediction would be. And compare that to maximum likelihood prediction is dh by dh plus dt. Okay? And so those of you who remember, so in essence, what the prior is doing is it is adding a plus b virtual samples. If you started with a beta ab, it's like you're not born yesterday. You already have seen a plus b number of coin tosses in which a of them came heads, b of them came tails. You're thinking I'm born yesterday and you're trying to put one over me, you know, but I know how coins work in this world. Okay, and so that is my prior, so it's like I have seen A plus B virtual samples even before you started tossing coins in front of me, and until you toss much more than A plus B, I will still try to modulate my estimation. This is actually exactly what you wound up doing in the naive Bayes classifiers by this fancy thing called Laplacian smoothing. Those of you who remember naive Bayes classifiers, basically if the counts are zero, then the entire probability will become zero. Okay, but this one would not become zero. So suppose you did only two tosses, both of them came tails. That means the probability of dh is zero, dt is two. So maximum likelihood will say zero by two, which is zero. Bayes will say a by a plus b plus two. Right? That A plus B is basically the Laplacian correction. So you can say Laplacian correction is a backdoor way of making maximum likelihood predictions be in line with Bayesian learning predictions. Okay? The real question, of course, is, all these priors are doing is allowing you to express your prior knowledge about the parameters. Naive Bayes is basically is a Bayes network learning, okay, for complete data, but the Bayes network is exactly two layers. So the theta create, so the network that you are learning essentially is of the form class creates symptoms, attributes. So suppose you're trying to learn, is the mail a spam or not spam? Class would be spam, not spam variable. All the attributes such as has the word Viagra in it, has the word Rav in it, is longer than 3 megabytes, all of these attributes are being supposedly caused by the class attribute. That's what naive-based learning is. And the assumption is it assumes this is the only structure, which means attributes are independent of all other attributes given the class. If you remember the Bayes network semantics, so probability of A2 and A3 given class would be probability of A2 given class times probability of A3 given class, because class is independently causing all the variables, all the attributes. Okay, so in naive-based learning, basically you basically use the counts, because complete, whether it's a big network or a small network, you always use counts. The only reason I said NBC is because many of you probably never thought of learning deep Bayes networks, even with complete data, before you came to this class. But you probably heard about naive Bayes classifiers. And there you did know that there was a Laplacian smoothing. That Laplacian smoothing can also be done for complete Bayes networks with deeper Bayes networks with complete data. And what Laplacian smoothing is doing is trying to account for the prior that you did not take into account. Okay. Now, the last thing that I want to say before I move out of this is, it's kind of interesting that you make such a big deal about priors and prior knowledge. Only in statistics would people have to almost apologize and argue until cows come home saying, you should allow me to take priors into account. Okay? Because in the statistical learning was originally done by statisticians who hated priors. Okay? As I already mentioned, lots and lots of normal learning is, done in the context of some prior knowledge. If you ever used background knowledge, then you have a prior. In deterministic case, if you have a logical case, right, then any logical theory you have about how the world works is being used to learn further. Okay, a classic case that I like is, for example, the Sao Paulo airport example. Okay, so you gotten down at Sao Paulo airport. And the first guy who showed up in front of you is wearing a red shirt, a green pant, and talking Portuguese. Okay, one person showed up, red shirt, green pant, talking Portuguese. I have some three hypotheses I would like to provide you for your consideration. Hypothesis one, all Brazilians, all Sao Paulians wear red shirts. Second hypothesis, all Sao Paulians wear green pants. Third hypothesis, all Sao Paulians talk Portuguese. Which one are you more likely to make? The third one. Yeah. Why? Because you have, you could say, well, I always knew that Brazilians speak Portuguese, in which case you barely needed learning. Okay, for the rest of the normal people, they may not know that Brazil is actually is an exception to the rule that most of South America speaks Spanish. Brazil is a huge exception, it speaks Portuguese. Okay, so you are actually doing a pretty surprising hypothesis that Brazilians speak Portuguese. Why? Because you have a very strong piece of knowledge that nationality tends to determine language, which is sort of true it's only approximately true, but it's pretty high probability that that is true. Whereas you don't think that nationality determines the color of one's clothing. That's why you are not ready to change your expectations about Brazilian's clothes based on the first Brazilian who wore a red shirt. But you're willing to change your hypothesis about Brazilians, language, which you may have thought originally. Maybe probably would be, Spanish, or I don't know. But then because I have this approximate determination, which says sort of nationalities determine languages, using that prior, I was able to learn. Without the prior, I'll take many more examples to learn. Okay, so whatever we did about prior is almost required, and statistical learning normally never had a role for priors if you do, you know, frequentist approach. But then frequentist approach becomes equal to the special case of just doing maximum likelihood estimation, which is a special case of Bayesian learning. And Bayesian learning allows, you know, you to take into account priors. And what's interesting is that you could have, to the extent you think this is telling you, the flavors and wrappers thing is telling you how flavors and wrappers are connected logically, but it's not deterministic logic, so it's, there's some probabilities involved. You can also have a prior on how the parameters are connected. So you could have a Bayes network on the parameters itself. That means they have connections between themselves. Normally, people, when they do Bayesian learning, they assume parameters are independent. That means there are no connections that go directly between two parameters. But you could have that too. So you could have pretty, you know, expressive way to express your priors over the parameters. The only problem then is, as you're doing this, you know, the thing that I pushed under the rug as to why MLE still continues to rule is, you know, is and why you would rather do MLE and do Laplacian smoothing than do Bayesian learning is because A, it's hard to get conjugate priors; B, it's hard to get closed form solutions to expected values over posterior. It was possible here. Okay? Questions? Yeah. That's true. No, that is true. So if you think that people with blonde hair are not particularly smart, right? You would basically throw away first 15 brilliant Einsteins with blonde hair. Einstein actually had blonde hair, right? And I mean, at least he had gray hair, because that's the only time we actually knew how Einstein looked. The only time we knew Einstein was after he became senile, unfortunately. You know, before that he used to have nice hair like me. Mine is gray. So the point is that if you have the prior, you know, the priors can help you, it can hinder you. No, I mean, I'll use your prior. You know, if I am doing adversarial reasoning, I will use your prior such that the examples I'm giving you are going to push you in the wrong direction. Yeah, that's fine. But what I'm saying is, it's not a counterexample. It's just, this is basically what statisticians will say. They will say that, look, all priors are bogus. Data is its only thing. Now, if I have less than A plus B samples, if A is 3 and B is 4, then I have less than 7 samples. Less than 7 samples, statistical significance of learning is out the window anyway. You're just saying instead of being out the window by 50%, it's out the window by 85%. Okay? But these are good things to think about. I mean, this is why people tend to say you should not have preconceived notions, you shouldn't be prejudiced. But that's bogus. Because if you didn't have preconceived notions, if you didn't have prejudices, or rather, if your ancestors didn't have preconceived notions and prejudices and thought, oh, this particular tiger, you know, it's true that all other tigers used to eat me, but this one could be different. Let me wait, in which case you won't be here. So there are no people left in the world who don't have prejudices and preconceived notions, okay, because they've all been weeded out. So you have to almost work against your prejudices and preconceived notions sometimes. But it's mostly a very useful thing. It's like, you know, I mean, far be it from me to say, knives are very useful things. You shouldn't use the knives to kill people, but knives can be used for many, many other things. Prejudices are very useful things. They make you go through life with few examples. Otherwise, you would basically drive everybody up the wall and will get eaten by every tiger that's passing by. Okay? Okay, so there is a summary, you know, of all the statistical learning stuff that we have done. I'm going to leave that there. You know, you can read this. And I want to move on to undirected probabilistic graphical models now, okay, which is basically Markov nets. The idea is, you already, whenever I had to give you a graphical model, I gave you BaseNet. Now I want to give Markov nets, and I want to sort of at least give you an idea of how Markov nets are specified, how inference is done on it, how learning is done on it. And if I live to see another day, I would hopefully also talk about Markov logic networks. Okay, but even otherwise, learning Markov net is not a bad thing at all, because that's the second half of graphical models, and people expect you to know it. Okay, so you know, this is graphical models essentially are used. You know, this is a review. You can read this. Graphical models are essentially used to provide a compact, factorizable format for a reasonably complex joint distribution. So in a Bayesian network, essentially a complex distribution over k variables is written as a product of some m distributions, where all those m are the CPTs. You just multiply the CPTs to get the joint distribution. That's what you do in Bayes networks. Okay? Now the same idea holds even for Markov networks. The bedrock of graphical models is you want to provide a complex distribution over n variables in terms of simpler factors over smaller number of variables. Instead of n, they may each of the simpler factors may be over less than d variables, and you multiply these factors to get the overall joint distribution. Now notice I use the word factor. Why didn't I say conditional probability tables to multiply it to get the full joint distribution? That was true in Bayes networks. It turns out that cannot always be true. The big difference between Markov networks and Bayes networks is, and that becomes clearer as we go on, is that the factors for Markov networks, you cannot make them have probabilistic semantics, unless in very special cases. Okay, now why is that? Because one of the big great things about Bayes network, and we talked about this in 471, is it doesn't matter how big the Bayes network is, right? However big the Bayes network is, okay, now each of these places, once the topology is decided, you know exactly what CPTs to fill. Now what's interesting is, so suppose this is A, B, C, D. Imagine they're all Boolean for now, okay? So all I'm going to ask in this is B, C, probability D given B, C. True, 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 false, false, true, false, false. I will allow you to put any four numbers there, any four numbers, as long as those numbers are positive and less than one. You cannot mess up specification of Bayes network. Do you understand what I'm saying? Any random four numbers would specify a consistent joint distribution. It may not be the one you wanted to give, but it's worse than, you try to put some numbers and it says, sorry, that's not a consistent distribution. You put some more numbers, say, sorry, that's not a consistent distribution. Then you don't know what numbers. You say, you put it yourself. Don't ask me anymore. Do you understand what I'm saying? The greatest thing in Bayes network that you take for granted is that CPTs are fully local. Okay? It's fully local. And you will never ask me to give, you'll always ask probability of D given B and C. You will never ask me probability of B given D. It's not that that probability is not defined, but you will never ask me. You, the Bayes network engineer, will never ask me that. That would be computed given the topology. Okay? So any numbers, any four numbers, X, Y, Z, W, such that all of them are less than 1, less than or equal to 1, and greater than or equal to 0, is enough. In fact, that's why I never even asked you what's the probability of not D given BC, because you may be bad in subtraction. Right? And then you might say, oh, this is 0.5 and this is 0.4. Then I'll say, what the heck are you talking about? So I won't ask you that. Ask the simplest number of questions such that you cannot go wrong. And if you're a knowledge engineer and the so-called expert is sitting there, they're already muddled in their thinking, right? And don't ask them questions that will put them into circles. If you are a cross, you know, if you are a prosecutor and you want to say the entire Bayes network that you guys made is bogus, you will ask them questions that will get them into cycles. But if you are a knowledge engineer, you want to write a network and go home. Right? So don't get them into trouble. And so you'll only ask numbers that they can't ever give wrongly. Okay, this is great. Now what, so keep this in mind when we talk about Markov network, because what happens in Markov network is there is no directionality, and so in essence you would have to, one way you could specify it is probability of a node given its neighbor. Neighborhood is symmetric. So if you ask me probability of D given B, C and this and this guy, then you'll also ask me probability of this, I'm sorry, probability of D given this, this, this and this, you will also later on ask me probability of this given this and this. I could be circular without knowing. I could be inconsistent. So if I already have an entire joint distribution figured out, and I'm using a Bayes network over that to give you the answers for the numbers that you are asking me, which by the way is what those of you who did 471 in the third project, you would re-parameterize a Bayes network, if you remember, where you would change the topology, and given the previous topology is correct, you can then specify the right CPTs just using the previous one, because you're using Bayes network to figure out what these numbers are. But nobody really knows what the entire just distribution is. They only know pieces. And so it's easy for them to get into trouble when you ask B given D as well as D given B. In Bayes networks, you would never do it. In Markov networks, which is undirected, you can do it. So that's why we talk about, there we talk in terms of factors rather than probability distribution. Okay? And those factors have this property that they're just numbers. They're positive numbers. They can even be greater than 5, less than 1, any real number. And then, of course, since these are all factors, then if you multiply them, then you would get a joint table with a huge number of numbers. One here says 2,000, here says 75, here says 3,955, here says 4,500. And we know that all these numbers must add up to 1. So you throw in the mother of all normalization factors, 1 over z, and say it's nothing but these factors multiplied divided by z, where z is correctly chosen such that everything will add up to 1. And it's that normalization factor that kills you in the end with Markov networks. I'm going ahead of the story, but you know, that's what I always do. So basically what happens is that normalization factor is going to depend upon every one of these numbers. And so when you try to find gradients over likelihoods and so on, then you will never have an equation with just a single parameter. You will have equations with single parameter entangled through the normalization factor with all other guys. That's the story that we're going to tell. Okay? So you know the directed models, and you know you can multiply that as multiplication of CPTs given the directed Bayes network. Undirected models, essentially, all you define in undirected model is a graph. There is no arrow anymore. The real issue is what are the semantics? The semantics for any graphical model are provided in terms of the conditional independences that will hold. Okay, remember, is X independent of Y given Z? For any random set of variables X, random set of variables Y, and random set of variables Z, I should be able to ask a question, is set of X, the set of variables X independent of set of variables Y given set of variables Z? And you should be able to answer it. And in Bayes networks, we knew how to do that using this deseparation criterion, which is a pretty painful criterion. Okay? Given that, you would be really happy to know that if you have an undirected model like this, and if you want to know, is this set independent of this set, given this set, all you need to do is remove the evidence set and see if the other two sets become disconnected. If so, they are independent. If not, they are not. This is too simple. This doesn't hold in Bayes networks. Okay? Do you see what I'm saying? So basically, what we are, in the only independence that you care about in in undirected models is the normal notion of separability of graphs. Given a graph, okay, given one set of vertices, another set of vertices, and a third set of evidence vertices, you would say that the evidence vertices separate the first two sets. If you remove the evidence vertices from the graph, there is no path from any guy in one set to any guy in the second set. Much simpler idea. Way much simpler idea. Because of which, it turns out that, remember there is this idea called Markov blanket? Remember the idea of Markov blanket? Markov blanket is your security blanket of all the people who, if you know their values, then it doesn't matter to you what happens to the rest of the world. What's the Markov blanket in the Bayes network? Yes, you better remember that. You know, I'm very happy that you remember that. In Bayes network, you know, normally you know that the specific independence that you tend to use in making the Bayes network algorithms, especially the exact ones, is the one which says a node is independent of its ancestors given its immediate parent. But that's not enough of a blanket. It only saves it from its ancestors. What about the nephews and nieces? To do that, essentially, you have to say a node is independent of everybody given its parents and the parents' children. Then you're independent. Okay? And that's a kind of a complex definition of Markov blanket. Okay? Now, there should be a Markov blanket for directed node next too. If this is the definition of independency, right? Basically, I want to make sure that this guy is independent of everybody else. That means there is no way, I mean, this guy should be made independent of everybody else given some subset of nodes. What would you do? Just give its neighbors. Just give its neighbors. No parents, no children, nothing, just simple neighbors. If you give my neighbors, then I'm independent of everybody else. This is more like what you tend to think of the world. You know, I mean, it's like my neighborhood. As long as my neighborhood is not going to the dogs, I don't care what happens to the world. Okay, the neighborhood kind of, you know, is saving me from the rest of the world. Okay, Bayes network model, which we learned first, is actually less intuitive. It's less intuitive because there you are dependent not only on your ancestors, but you're also on your descendants. Here, there is no ancestors and descendants. All neighbors. And you just remove the neighbors and you'll be fine. So the two things I told you that are good about Markov networks. One, independence assertions are easy. Second, because of which Markov blanket is easy. Now, it turns out, so the Markov blanket slide is this. Right? For example, for Bayes network, this node, Markov blanket is this. Okay, because the node's own descendants have to be taken into account. Okay, whereas, you know, here is a nice little Markov network, and it's not surprising, you know, this looks sort of like an image with each of these as the image pixel. In fact, images can be very nicely modeled as Markov networks. If you think in terms of intensity at each point in an image as a random variable, all you are saying is its intensity depends on its neighbor's intensities. But then the neighbor's own intensity depends on these guys as well as those guys. That's where the circularity in giving the numbers works. Okay? So Markov blanket is good. Now, if Markov blanket is good, and then it turns out that those of you who might remember one great sampling-based algorithm that we didn't use it this semester, one great sampling-based algorithm for Bayes network, approximate inference algorithm called Markov chain Monte Carlo. And what Markov chain Monte Carlo would do is this beautiful idea where if I'm trying to compute some formula over this Bayes network, it starts by giving some random, suppose these are all Boolean variables, give them some random assignment, 1, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 0, 1, 1, blah, blah, blah. So now I have a completely specified network. Then what I will do is, so I have one complete interpretation of the network. If you think of these as n variables, n propositions, then I started with a single interpretation now. I want to generate a new interpretation. How do I generate a new interpretation? I pick any of these guys, sample it given its Markov blanket. Given its Markov blanket. Now the interesting thing is that in Bayes network, if I give you the entire Markov blanket, sampling this guy is not all that easy. If I just gave you this and this, sampling this is easy. But if I gave you this, then sampling this, I have to get its posterior distribution and then decide what are the odds of odds of heads and tails, as a true and false. And it gets some influence from the parents and some diagnostic influence from the children. Okay? In fact, let me just show you that this is sort of a you have seen this at some point of time. Okay. I have shown this slide back when we were doing Markov chain Monte Carlo in 471, where essentially if this was this little network, notice that the chain is over the entire network. So each node in this network is an interpretation over the network variables values. Okay? And then you wind up, selecting, going from one to other by essentially sampling that node given its Markov blanket. And the basic idea of Markov chain Monte Carlo is that if you do this long enough, then you will reach a steady state distribution for the Markov chain. And the steady state distribution for the Markov chain turns out to be, remember, this is a Markov chain over interpretation. So this is true, 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 false. This is true, false, false, true, like that. In the joint probability distribution table, these are the rows. And what you need is numbers, such that they all add up to one. The steady state distribution of this Markov chain can be proven to be exactly the joint distribution of the Bayes network. And you remember that if you have the joint distribution, you can answer every query. Right? So that's the basis of Markov chain Monte Carlo. It's one of the most powerful methods that everybody uses. Now the interesting thing is, in using Markov chain Monte Carlo for Bayes networks, I need to compute the probability of a node given its Markov blanket. Unfortunately, Markov blanket would not just be its immediate parents, which is what CPTs tell you. It also includes the descendants. So you actually need to do this computation. This number, value of xi given its parents, that can be read from the CPT, and this other number comes from the Bayes rule. Children given the parent. I'm sorry, parent given the children is basically using the CPTs at the children table to compute their influence on the parent. Okay? That's what Markov chain Monte Carlo has to do. It has to do this slightly complex computation for the posterior of each node, and once you get the posterior, and if it's like a Boolean variable, then posterior will tell you 0.7 probability it is true, 0.3 it is false, then you toss a coin which comes heads with 0.7 probability, and whatever it says, that's what is your sample. Right? Now the interesting thing is, had this not been a Bayes network, suppose if all of these were undirected arcs, then it turns out that there is no difference between neighbors and Markov blanket. And we will actually see that we will be specifying that the easiest way to provide factors for Markov networks, the easiest way to provide factors for Markov networks is basically taking cliques, given the network, take the cliques, and for each clique, provide what's called a potential function. Okay? So in particular, let's say here is a clique. Okay, so this is the same network except I removed all the arcs. So now it became undirected. So what I would be doing is here x6 is form of this maximal clique, x1, x2, x5. So I need for each valuation of x6, x5, x2, a number. you may think of it as probability number. Next time I'll argue with you that you cannot make them probabilities, because just as I, so basically these potentials are, how likely is it that x6 will be true, x2 will be true, x5 will be true? How much of internal attraction do they have? And then x6 false, x2 false, x5 true, how much internal attraction does that have? And these basically are the potentials, and what you are trying to then find is the minimal energy. This actually, these undirected Markov models came from physics, statistical mechanics, where they are looking for the minimal energies for a system. So there's a lot of that terminology that comes in, which we'll talk about next class too. Okay, so the point of course is, you know, here you can put any number in each of those cells. You can put any number, positive number, any positive number. In fact, negatives are also fine actually. Okay, and if you do that, then multiplying all those tables will give me a bigger table, which will have just as many rows as the number of entries in the joint probability distribution, except they don't add up to anything like 1. So you throw in a z and say, you know, z is the partition function which will make sure that everything adds up to 1. Okay, so here in this particular case, if I have a much simpler Markov net, 3 nodes, this, this and this, so I have 2 clicks. This is one click, this is another click. A click is a completely connected subgraph, right? So x1 and xi minus 1, if it is minus 1 and minus 1 and 1 and 1, so minus 1 being false and 1 being true, okay? Here are the potentials I gave. So what this is telling me is the minus 1, good. Plus 1, good. Minus 1, plus 1, not so good. Plus 1, minus 1, not so good. That means these guys tend to stick together. They like to have the same valuation. Okay? These look, sort of look like the payoff matrices in the game theory, but really they're just potentials. This is how much of an attraction do you have for this particular valuation? And similarly for this guy, I gave a different one. Okay? In this case too, it turned out, in fact, I gave the exact same thing, you know. So I'm basically, so in this case essentially, this is a Markov net which is sort of repeating. It's a templated Markov net. This part is repeating multiple times. Now if you do this, then if you multiply these two, then if you multiply these two, then I will get the probability distribution P of X. Joint distribution is defined as multiplication of all those potentials. Okay? So basically if I want to know what is the probability that x1 is true, x2 is true, x3 is true, then I will look into every subtable which says anything about x1 true, x2 true, x1 true, x3 true, x2 true, x3 true, multiply all those numbers. Okay? And if I do that, then I will get all the joint distribution entries. I just have to divide it by a z, where z essentially says all of them should add up to 1. And this is called the partition function, and people shudder at it because this guy combines everybody into a mess. You know, it's like, you know, the reason actually you want these to be potentials is when you are asking your expert to provide these numbers, they can provide these numbers without thinking maybe they'll get into a, you know, problem in being inconsistent. You ensure consistency by dividing everything by z and everything adds up to 1. Now you could say, give me exactly probability numbers, some sort of a conditional probability number, and if you do that, you would have asked probability of x given its neighbor, as well as probability of this guy given these two, as well as probability of this guy given these two. And those better be related. You can't just randomly pick up numbers. Whereas in this, you could pick up any number between 0 and 1 and introduce it into any cell. So experts have their, they don't have to worry about what makes it easy for your stupid computer program to have a good life. They only need to worry about what is right for the domain. So the long answer for this is that you go with potentials rather than probabilities, and then you multiply the potentials and divide it by a z to make it all be an actual joint distribution. Once it is a joint distribution, everything else falls through. I mean, everything else falls through just as before. You can compute anything. Okay, and in particular, it turns out that the Markov chain Monte Carlo is a great approach for doing approximate inference on Markov nets. Why? Because each of these are potential functions are telling you x1 given its neighbors. I mean, the joint distribution over x1 and its neighbors. And Markov blanket is your neighbor. So you never have to look for anything other than the potential function to compute the Markov blanket posterior. Okay? So think about this. Next class when we come back, I want to talk to you about obviously inference, which is just Markov chain Monte Carlo, and also mention that in the case of learning, you know, what happens in the case of learning is this nice little slide here which you get to look at, which basically says that, you know, the log likelihood now has, you know, if you have just two weights, you know, two potential functions here, A to B and B to C, then it winds up, you know, the log likelihood will have a plus for this and a plus for this and a minus of the normalizing constant, which includes both of the parameters. So when you take the derivative now and set it equal to zero, you don't hold your breath and expect that each of the derivatives, partial derivatives, will just be talking about one single parameter. Instead, they'll talk about arbitrarily, you know, any set of parameters. And so you really normal, even for the complete data case, you still need to do gradient ascent in the case of Markov network. For Markov net. Yeah, that's basically what we are talking about. We'll say more next class, but what we mean by problem is that when you take the derivative, it turns out that the derivative would wind up requiring you, I mean, it would first of all not give a simple expression on a single parameter. Okay, and so you really have to do gradient ascent, which is the normal thing you do for function optimization. Okay, but I mean, you can think of this as a bad thing, but you can think of everything else as a good thing for Markov nets. Because if you really want to talk about, you know, the probability distribution for an image, let's say, how the intensities at different points in an image are correlated, you can't say that one particular image point is the parent of other image points. Images only have correlations, they don't have causation. Everybody is equal. It's just neighborhood. I don't cause my neighbor doesn't cause me. But we'll sink or swim together, which is exactly what Markov networks capture. Whereas if you have causation, Bayes networks capture that better. Okay? And so you need both, really. In fact, there is an expressiveness issue that we talked about some time back in a previous class, but I'll mention it next time again. That I don't have this here, that there are certain distributions that can't be exactly represented by Bayes nets, but can be represented by Markov nets. There are other distributions that can't be exactly represented by Markov nets, but can be represented by Bayes nets. And there is a subset which can be represented both ways. Which, by the way, means that if you are lucky enough to be stuck with a distribution that is written as a Markov net form, but actually has an equivalent Bayes net, and if you are learning, you may as well learn the parameters for the Bayes net. Because Bayes net learning is easier. Okay? And it turns out that the chain things, such as A causing B, in fact, the one that I showed you, I'll go back on this later on again, don't worry. The one that I just showed you here, this can actually be seen as either a Markov net or a Bayes net. And it makes no difference. And so, in fact, you know, I'll send you like a write-up on this from another book, and that they basically say, after having set this up, we'll say, well, since it's a caudal graph, and caudal graphs have this property that they can be written as both Bayes networks or Markov nets, we could just learn it as a Bayes net. Okay, I mean, that's the advantage of knowing two different languages. You learn the concept in whatever language is easy. So when I started learning Spanish, for example, I originally spoke Telugu, and I started seeing, oh, all these, you know, Spanish looks very different from English, but it has all these interesting connections with Telugu, so it was easy for me to learn. Okay, but this expressivity issue is essentially saying that there are certain things that can only be said in English and not in Telugu, and vice versa. That's unfortunately not true, hopefully, for natural languages, but they're true for probabilistic graphical models. Okay, we'll get back next time.